It's time for The Car Doctor on AM 950 WROL. Got a car question? Call us at 617-770-3030. That's 617-770-3030. Now, here's The Car Doctor, John Paul, on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston.
And good Saturday morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston. Or maybe you're listening on Sunday night, and it's AM 1260 WBIX. Or maybe you're listening on the podcast, on one of the many podcast channels. TuneIn, podcasts.com, Podomatic, wherever you could, iTunes, wherever you could be listening. And if you are listening to our podcast, thank you very much. Well, today may not feel like a winter day, because I guess it's supposed to be almost 60 degrees this afternoon. But I'm pretty sure we're going to have winter weather at some point, and we've already had it, it seems like. I think we were down to 20 degrees one morning not that long ago. But, you know, winter weather will be here soon, and it's time to think about winter tires, or at least know what they are. And there's no better person to tell us about winter tires than Ron Margadonna from Michelin. We'll just call him the Michelin Man. Ron, good morning, and welcome back to the Car Doctor program.
Good morning, John. It's a pleasure being back on your show this morning.
And thank you for taking a little time out of what I guess is a Thanksgiving weekend for joining us up here in Boston. So I appreciate you putting down some turkey and spending some time with us. So
no problem at all. That's not a problem.
Well, you know, let's talk about, you know, winter a little bit and tires. I happen to be having the pleasure of driving a Mercedes with sport tires on it, and I even noticed when the weather dropped to cooler temperatures, the tires were like hockey pucks. They didn't have a lot of traction capabilities, and that's pretty standard these days with performance tires, right?
No, you're absolutely right, John Paul. What I think maybe most drivers don't know is some of the tires that have come equipped on their vehicle when it's new are adapted for summer conditions. And then when you get into winter, those tires, the way they're designed, are not suitable for good performance, you know, when it gets cold weather, and obviously when we get snow and ice on the ground. So as temperatures drop well below freezing, we expect, we just need winter mobility, and it's best basically to change over to winter tires.
Hmm. Yeah, the other thing is all season tires. I remember back many, many years ago, I was talking to a tire expert, and he said to me, well, an all season tire is 70% as good as a snow tire in 4 to 6 inches of snow. And I think maybe 30 years ago, an all-season tire was like that, but now it seems like an all-season tire is, to me, more almost like a three-season tire in New England, or maybe an all-season tire where you don't really get as much snow. Is that just my impression, or is that closer to truth?
No, I think what was mentioned to you years ago pretty much is still true today, that I think most people don't understand that an all-season tire, although it is all-season and can be used year-round, it certainly has restrictions during that winter season when winter gets extreme. And I think your definition of 4 to 6 inches of snow, we refer to it as a light to moderate snowfall.
Okay.
Region, certainly not the Boston area, but in areas maybe further south than you, you know, in Atlantic, something of that, where it gets more of a casual winter. You know, that type of thing. And certainly the other thing, as I mentioned, is the cold temperature. So you may not have, you know, the snow and ice, but you could have cold temperature. And all-season tires, although they're better than what we call the summer tire, they're no substitute for winter tires, which are compounded for those extreme freezing nights, or even when it gets down to the teens or even down to zero. And, you know, there's no substitute for the winter. And it comes down to the way the rubber is compounded. The way to think of it is that, so as temperature comes down, rubber tends to harden.
Mm-hmm.
So as the way we compound or formulate the tread compound recipes, we have ingredients in there to remain flexible. When you get down to those, I call it the teens or even, you know, single digits, to remain flexible for, you know, your tractor grip. If you're too hard, and this is why you were opening with the tires on your new Mercedes, I think you said, or summer, they're not compounded to go down to those temperatures, and they get very brittle and hard, and they don't give you a lot of traction grip in those conditions.
Well, let me just clarify. It's really not my Mercedes. It's just my Mercedes for a few days, so.
Well, let's consider it your Mercedes, at least.
Okay. But
no, you know, I think that's a big miss. I mean, all season tires, even though there's a little marking M plus S, a lot of people realize or interpret that as suitable for winter season. But I think what they have to understand is that's for a very light winter type environment. That's the point to be made.
So in winter, in true winter weather, or where the temperatures drop to sub-freezing temperatures, there's no substitute for a good winter tire, right?
That is correct.
Yep.
That is correct. And if I may add, just to help your audience out, the way to distinguish which manufacturer has a winter tire is there is a symbol that is placed on the side of all the tire. It looks like a mountain peak with a snowflake in it. And that is a performance standard that all the manufacturers must meet to put that marking on the tire. And that designates that tire as suitable for a much more extreme winter conditions.
Yeah, in some parts of the country, some areas that really get a lot of snow, the requirement is you have to have that that mountain snowflake thing on your tire to travel on those roads, right?
That's correct. And it's out west part of our country in the Rocky Mountains, where you get into like Colorado, you get into the Cascades. The Highway Patrol in those areas are looking for that symbol to allow passage through the mountains, because they know that symbol is a true winter tire, not a substitute for winter tire for, you know, mobility and safety. So you are correct. We'd like to see it more widespread and more communicated, but it is certain areas do require that.
And I'm in a second floor studio here, and I'm kind of staring out in the parking lot on a quiet Saturday morning. And there's probably five SUVs out in the parking lot, and an SUV with all wheel drive certainly is better in the winter. But with a winter tire, there's improvements in traction, not just to get going, but for stopping ability as well, right?
Well, I think we need to maybe just caution here just a little bit. When we look at systems like four-wheel drive and all-wheel drive, basically what they do is they proportion the engine horsepower or the power of the engine into more drive wheels. So there is an advantage for starting traction, mm-hmm, or starting acceleration. But when it comes to stopping or even cornering, you know, those systems really don't provide much advantage.
Right.
So I think the understanding here is that you're safe when you have four-wheel drive. Well, consider that there's three things that the tires do in contact with the road. You either accelerate, you either stop, or you corner. Those are the three. Only one of those three is provided by the four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive system, which is the starting traction. Again, braking is not affected, nor is cornering. So the best way that we recommend is the safest and get the most mobility is there's no substitute for any of the systems.
Yeah.
All-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, you're the safest for mobility.
Hmm. Yeah, and you know, the other thing, we did some testing at AAA, and we found out, you know, even though tires are considered worn out in most states at 230 seconds of tread, the difference between 230 seconds and 430 seconds can have a big difference on your stopping and handling ability, right?
Well, yeah, obviously, deeper tread tires from new all the way down are going to give you better performance for stopping and for braking, whether it be snow, wet, or whatever. So, yes, I think, you know, paying attention to your tread depth as you enter into the winter season.
Right.
Because the winter season is going to be 5-6 months. You may make an educated say, well, my tires are maybe not exactly 230 seconds, which is illegal, but maybe right. I want to replace them just to get through the winter so they don't have that hassle. So I think that's a good thought for, you know, anybody that's listening, just to get their tires in. And by the way, I heard you mention that there's no snow on the ground, but this is a good time to maybe go in for service when nobody else is.
you're absolutely right. And, you know, there's a few important things. And these days we see the Michelin name not just on tires. I know the last time I replaced the wiper blades on my car was at the auto parts store, and there were Michelin mm-hmm. wiper blades, and there was sort of a little bit of a hybrid blade. There was sort of a combination between a wiper and a regular blade, and they worked out great.
Right, right. So we listened to the name, and of course, when you have Michelin license, it has to be of the finest and highest quality,
yep.
you know, standards before we put our name on. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Hey, Ron, we gotta get going, but if people want more information about Michelin tires or Michelin products in general, where can they go?
Okay, so we have a whole section devoted to winter, like Michelin, www.michelinman.com. There's a lot of maintenance. There's a lot of winter driving tips that can mm-hmm. be found on there. You know, we only have so much time. We can only talk so much today, but there's a lot of helpful hints on what to do during winter to help you.
So it's Michelinman.com is the website, and how you get all that information. You find out more about winter car care, winter maintenance, winter driving, and hopefully we all get through the winter season safely and efficiently, right?
Exactly. That's the goal.
Hey, Ron, thanks for taking some time out of your Saturday morning and joining us up here in Boston.
Okay, John, have a good day.
You Bye-bye. As well. Take care. Bye-bye. That was Ron Margadonna. He is the, we'll call him the Michelin man, but he is the technical expert for Michelin Tire Company. Why don't we take a break, pay some bills? My name's John Paul. This is a Car Doctor program. Phone lines are wide open at 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. We'll be right back.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409. Well, I saved my pennies.
And welcome back to the Car Doctor program on AM950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston, or Salem Broadcasting, or Salem Multimedia, wherever you happen to be listening. I know, Dennis, this will appeal to you. We still haven't caught up to the Jetsons, this article says. All those futurists who made grandiose promises about flying cars decades ago are now dead. And the cars, at least as most of them, remain gravitationally challenged, according to this little article. It says, but three recent events, deregulation of light aircraft construction requirements, development of hybrid electric powertrains, and broad acceptance of shared mobility ownership models are for the first time drawing large amounts of cash into development of point-to-point personal air transportation vehicles. Will there be flying cars? Probably not. Nor will there be rotable airplanes. Instead, what is being developed is vertical takeoff and landing vehicles with a hybridized engine that would, for example, pick up four people at an airport, fly them autonomously about 25 miles to a landing site in the center of a metro area such as Manhattan. Such vehicles won't ever be in the average person's garage because they'll cost $750,000 or more in today's dollars, experts say, but they'll be far quieter than helicopters, making them less noise nuisance and allowing for development of airborne ride-hailing services to take people on short hops from point to point. So I don't think you're getting your flying car anytime soon.
Dang it.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, is that place that was developing the flying
cars? Yeah,
up cars?
In Burlington, yeah. Terra Fugia.
Are they still around?
They are. A couple years ago, probably 2 years ago, they had their concept at the New York Auto Show. The problem is, so far, the one they show flying is really an airplane, and the one they show taxiing around out of the person's garage and pulling into the gas station is kind of a golf cart with fold-up wings. But they haven't really taken the fold-up wing one and actually flown it yet. So now they have a new one or a new concept that they've come up with. I still haven't seen it flying yet.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when the last time I was here and really looking into it, they were starting to take deposits on people saying that they were going to have actual production vehicles out within a year. That was, I mean, I haven't been here for 5 years, so that's at least 5 to 7 years ago.
Yeah. So, you know, if you have a flying car in your garage, give us a call at 617-770-3030 and let us know. And over the years, I mean, there's been a lot of different tries. You know, Corvair, actually, somebody had a Corvair that kind of flew, I guess. And, you know, somebody, you know, in the 50s, it was kind of, but there were sort of cars with wings that sort of did something. But the idea of, you know, driving out of your garage, driving down the road until you find some place to vertically take off and fly. I don't know. I don't see that happening right away. I saw a concept of a kind of flying motorcycle helicopter thing, which was fairly interesting. And it looked like a motorcycle. It had two wheels, looked like a motorcycle, and it had a rotor blade on it. You could ride it around at, you know, 90 miles an hour like a motorcycle. And then you would engage the wing and fly a little bit more, and the rotor would start to spin, and then you could take off. So, you know, it's a concept still. Although I was watching some, I think I was just flipping through channels, you know, for us that still have cable, unlike you.
Yeah, no, I'm beyond cable.
You're beyond cable. You're a cord cutter.
Well, until that net neutrality goes away.
Yeah, yeah. We can talk about that, too, because I don't fully understand that either. So, but I was flipping through the stations, and I came across some business channel, and it showed what amounted to a four-rotor drone that was fully autonomous, and you got in it. So it was big enough to get in, little pod, and you programmed it, and the thing was supposed to take off. And it's being developed in China, and they just applied for doing testing in Dubai because they have more money than they know what to do with. So let's go buy a $1 million drone thing and fly around. But it was it appeared to be all electric. They were testing it. It looked like it worked. And in the same company, they were also testing little drones, and they had one deliver a cup of coffee to someone, which was kind of cute, but got to think the coffee gets cold by the time it gets there. But yeah, the idea of, you know, flying cars, you know, if we have true flying cars, how often will you need to buy tires?
Never.
Exactly. Never. Exactly.
Well, you'd still need to have snow tires, because I don't think it would be too keen to fly in
the snow. So that's when you actually,
weather.
Yeah. See, there's the inherent problems with a flying car. And I can't think of the guy's name. There was another guy who had this concept of a flying hover car thing that had four ducted fan engines in it that was supposed to hover straight up and then take off, or kind of take off. And he had one concept where it was where it had a bunch of rotors around it. It looked kind of like a flying saucer, but all I ever saw it do was fly on the end of a tether. The actual concept one, still never saw that one take off either. So, you know, someday maybe, but considering I saw my little drive from where I live to here, I saw two people go through stop signs. One person passed on the double yellow line on front of Wollaston Beach. I don't know. People in flying cars scare me. Our phone number is 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Let's get Dennis to catch up here. Let's talk to Paul. Hey, Paul.
John.
How are you?
Yeah, fine. Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess they've got to improve the flex capacitor to...
At least the flex capacitor. But
yeah, I guess. I mean, obviously talking about the DeLorean and then Back to the Future... which was that a flying car? I suppose it could be
considered a time machine. Really. There was a time machine. I think that's a little, I don't even think Dennis is dreaming of one of those. Are you?
But it became a flying
car. But it did become a flying car. Okay. It did, I suppose. Yeah.
Probably that's the most use anybody ever got out of a DeLorean, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's funny. Years and years ago, when I worked in a garage, it was a woman who came in with a DeLorean. And she appeared to have hit everything but the lottery in it. It was dented and dinged on all corners because they're a little awkward to drive. And they weren't very good cars either. They had this sort of generic Renault Volvo Peugeot V6 engine in them that leaked oil more than a Corvair. And she hated it, and she was thinking of just getting rid of it. And she didn't want a lot of money for it. And I ran it down the street to a body shop and asked the guy at the body shop if he could knock all the dents out of it and paint the stainless steel. But by the time it was done, it was probably going to be an $8,000 paint job. And at the end, it was going to be, okay, now I'm going to have a blue DeLorean that still leaks oil and isn't all that much fun to drive. So I quickly talked myself out of it. So but yeah, they're still around, and apparently there's someone going to try to build them again. So
probably a collector's item for some people.
Yeah, although it's sort of like there used to be a car, and there's one I see around here every once in a while, it was some sort of safety car. And it was a gullwing thing with big ugly bumpers on it, and they're sort of collector's items too, but they're not really going for a whole heck of a lot of money. So,
I grew up in Quincy, and one of my neighbors had a gullwing Mercedes back in.
Oh yeah, those are worth several million dollars now. So
yeah, well yeah. I guess I mean they probably were worth that to begin with, the guy who owned it. But that's yeah, it was silver. I still remember it.
Mm-hmm.
But going. But it was funny you talk about tires, because I took advantage of your friends at Sullivan Tire that had I needed tires for my car. I could probably wait till spring, but the two front were I've forgotten them. The millimeters in the front were not as good as the back.
Yep.
And it was buy two get four tires.
Yep.
And I'm sure you always get, you know, and there were just two brands to select from. I'm real happy. I got a tire. I guess it's a Canadian tire. I did some research first. Called a Sailun.
Okay.
Sailun, and it's an Atrezzo all-weather, all-season tire. And it was... I just got it yesterday, just driving around, and it's much quieter than the Nexum tires I had on there before. Now, I mean, a mid-grade tire, you know, the entry-level tire, but they have 45,000-mile warranty on it, and I have 66,000 miles on the car. And the next grade up was like $400 more for the next grade tire. And I didn't think it was worth it, and I think I'm glad I made the choice that I did.
Mm.
It's a
tire that's they've been producing truck tires for a lot of years, and they just started to import them through a Canadian distributor and into the United States. And people who have used them have been pretty happy with them. I remember several years ago, I think we had the marketing director or something for the company on the show, and he was telling us about the quality control and everything that goes into making the tire. And they are just that. They're an affordable alternative. You know, it's a name that people don't recognize, but that's what they're trying to do, is get their name out there. Just like the Korean tires like Hankook and Kumho that nobody heard of 10 years ago, and now you see them original equipment on a lot of cars, including some performance sports cars.
Yeah, I mean, it's a marked improvement over the other tires that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And one that they did also an alignment, and the tech I talked to said they adjusted the camber on the rear tires. I never knew there was, I thought they were kind of stationary. But,
no, there's a little bit of adjustment on the back as well. Not as much. Years ago, the only... You know, 40 years ago, the only cars that ever had rear wheel adjustment were sports cars like Ferrari. And now it's cars that a lot of cars have them. All cars now have a measurement for rear wheel alignment, although they're not always adjustable. But it still gives you a reference point to be able to make sure the car goes down the road straight. And one of the things I like about Sullivan Tire is that they have the absolute latest in alignment equipment. And they are just so up to date on that sort of stuff. They have their own little Sullivan Tire University that they send their techs to make sure that they do a good job. In fact, even something as simple as you know, repairing a tire. I think they spend a whole day with people making sure it's done right and look for signs of damage and things like that. So they do an awfully good job.
I was really impressed with them. I mean, they even had a shuttle bring me back and pick me up.
Yep.
Well, they did it. And the one thing that the tech told me that, you know, we were talking about name brand tires, Michelin, all the brand names that you know, Bridgestone. He was telling me that even if you get them as original tires on a new car, let's say Mazda or Ford or GM, they go to the tire manufacturer and they bid on those tires to be installed in all their cars. But it's not, he said, necessarily the very same tire that you would get if you went to Sullivan Tire. They're built to the standards of whatever their car manufacturer is.
Yeah, it's so, sort of funny because there are some things, for instance, if you get, say, the battery that's in your car is made by Johnson Controls, which is one of the three or four battery manufacturers in the country, and they build that battery, original equipment for your car, a lot of times that battery is better quality than the replacement battery you're going to get, even though it's made exactly the same to fit that exact same car. Where tires, it's kind of just the opposite. The original equipment tire on a car, a lot of times, might only last 30 or 40,000 miles, where the replacement tire that looks exactly the same is actually a better quality tire, even though it has exactly the same name on it and it looks the same. But you're right. They bid them out price-wise. If they know they're going to be able to, you know, sell a manufacturer 100,000 tires, they're going to make a tire for them. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, that tire is more based on price than quality, even though they're always, tires are always kind of a compromise. They're a compromise of ride and handling and stopping ability and quiet. And a lot of times the compromise is the longevity of the tire is offset by the ride and price of the tire. So
the Mazda that I had came with Michelin's initially, and you're right, they didn't last very long. I think I had to replace them 25 or 30,000 miles. And I really wasn't impressed. I mean, I've had Michelin's before and other cars. You know, nice name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but how many people get down on their knees and read the sidewall, you know?
I do, but, you know.
Well,
but,
yeah.
There's something wrong with me, but, you know. You're right. You know, what you want to look for is a tire that's going to perform well, it's going to fit your budget, and it's going to work, it's going to do everything you need it to do, so.
Yeah, it did. I mean, and there was another selection of a tire, and I think it was Sumitomo, I think was that, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, was the other tire. But the tech I talked to recommended this one, and so I, you know, so far I'm really pleased with Sullivan Tire and the tires. I don't know if I really saved anything, you know. I wondered whether they jacked up the labor cost a little bit.
You know, is there really ever such a thing as a free lunch?
No. I know that. I mean, they're running the ad right now.
Right.
I just heard Jordan Rich do it. You know, buy three, get one free. Yep.
And it's a funny thing about tires. When my very first job out of school, I worked at the Uniroyal Tire Store, which there was one in Braintree at the South Shore Plaza and one in Brockton. And they sold bicycles and stoves and refrigerators and just about everything. And I remember then, you know, what people thought about tires and, you know, and now, you know, as we've, you know, fast forwarded a whole bunch of years, the tire business back then, there was actually profit made in tires. Now, realistically, there isn't a lot of money made in tires. And in fact, a lot of even car dealerships will match price on tires. So if you go to a tire store and then go to the, you know, Ford garage and say, hey, I went to here and looked at a certain price, will you match the price? In some cases, they'll match the price and lose money on it if they have to try to match the price from whoever they're buying them from. So, yeah, the idea that I've talked to, you know, some garage owners, they'll buy tires wholesale and resell them to the customers, and they're literally making $5 a tire.
Well, I was thinking of buying it online, but then I thought, well, I've got to deliver them and then find a gas station that will install them, and what about the aligning? So maybe I would have saved some money, but I don't know in the long run whether
Yeah. No, the buying them online to me, where that really makes sense, if you bought a set of wheels and tires together and you plan on switching them over yourself, and then then some, to me that sort of makes sense. But I have also I think the last time, not this car but the car before, my wife's car, I went to like Tire Rack or something and went online and looked at the price, and then went to Sullivan Tire and said, Tire Rack is this price, what can you do? And they said, we'll match it.
Well, that's good. I remember when I was a kid, my parents used to buy tires at the local gas station, Egan's, in Quincy, which was really good. I suppose they still sell tires, but they used to be Uniroyal. It was the big, Uniroyal was probably the big tire name at the time. They were before radials. I'm getting older, and I remember cars before radials. That's a good question. Between the first tires that, at this point I've forgotten what the tires were called before radials, non-radials, I guess.
Bias ply tires.
It's steel belted bias ply.
In fact, because you remember stuff when you were young, with the Uniroyal tires, there was a Zeta 20, a Zeta 30, and a Zeta 40. And the Zeta 20 was a bias ply tire. The Zeta 30 was a steel belted bias ply tire, and the Zeta 40 was a steel belted radial tire. And if you ever see a car with the license plate, I think it's Zeta 30. It's Paul Sullivan.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, so he had one of the originals.
Yeah.
The steel belts would occasionally break off.
The early ones were not good. You switched them from side to side; they came apart and fell apart. And there was some development that took place back in the old days.
I'm waiting for White Walls to come back.
There you go. All right, hold your
thank
breath.
You. Have a happy rest of the weekend.
You as well. Okay. Take care. Bye bye.
Thanks.
617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Remember, you're listening to the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. Let's talk to Tom.
Hello. Hello. Yeah. Hi, John. How are you?
Good. How are you?
You can call me Tim. That's okay.
I'd rather call you Tom.
I've been called worse. All right, John, working on my 70s Jeep. My question is, okay, if I don't run it for a few days, I notice that the carburetor, the fuel, seems to be gone from the bowl because it's not pumping any out of the jets.
Okay.
So I installed a clear inline filter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was a filter in there, but it was metal, you couldn't see. Okay, so when you get it started and the filter fills up and you can see it pretty much full, three mm-hmm. quarters. So if it sits, that tends to seem like it drains down. After a few days,
mm-hmm.
when it's you just shut it off, it's up to three quarters mm-hmm. full clear. You can see it.
Yep.
If it sits for a few days, you can see that it's going down. Is that going back through the fuel pump?
It's making its way back to the pump. The pump has and when that pump, it doesn't take much for that pump when the engine cranks over and the lever on the fuel pump moves, it doesn't take much. That can in literally 15 seconds, it can fill a quart container halfway full. So it doesn't take any more than just cranking the engine over to, fill that gas filter back up. But on the other hand, if you're losing gas out of the carburetor, there's either a check ball that's leaking or it's probably a check ball that's leaking in the carburetor that's allowing fuel to go to either drain into the engine or drain backwards. So
it's either going in through the manifold, the intake. But I don't really think that's the issue. I think it's draining the other way. But yep. I mean, the bowl would be filled, so it could be leaking through the little.
Yeah, if the carburetor was completely empty and you closed the choke. With the choke closed and the engine cranking over, even if there was almost no fuel pump on the car, it would suck fuel right out of the tank because it creates enough of a vacuum to do that. So I think chances are there's some dirt in the carburetor somewhere that's letting letting the bowl and the carburetor drain, which is why and it may not be draining fully. It just may be draining from the accelerator pump cavity that's there. Is the accelerator pump? Do you know? Is it a pump that sits in a chamber, or is it like sit flat on the side of the carburetor? Is it like a lever that looks like
it's mounted on the? It's mounted. Well, if you're looking at the engine on the front, yeah, you can see that. I know the one. Yep. I know what you're saying. Yep. Yeah, that's mounted to the front on where the bowl would be, like to the front side of the bowl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
more or less.
Yeah, I mean, you might. You know, usually it's held on with four screws and it's got a little lever on it. And
you know,
you might want to even get a carburetor kit. You know, order one online, get a carburetor kit, and even if you don't rebuild the whole carburetor, change the accelerator pump diaphragm and the little check ball that sits under it.
Right, but the accelerator pump, I mean, works fine.
Oh, it does.
It's
okay.
That, yeah, no, that's working fine. That's really the issue. When I look, when I go to start it, what I'll do is I'll look right down the throat first because I know it's not going to start. And if you hit the accelerator pump, you're not getting any spray. Now, so if I prime the engine with a little fuel right down the throat and start it, and it starts, and you see the fuel filter filling up.
Yep.
Then it's fine. Then you go over, it's pumping. So it's not, it's somewhere, it's either multiple problems. I'm thinking maybe when it fills up the bowl and you have that needle seat, either that's leaking, but then also it's going past that. And that's why I was wondering if the fuel pump itself, could it back drain past that? I don't know.
I suspect you're overthinking it a little bit. I think what you really have is just a check ball in the carburetor that's not seating properly and allowing the gas to drain back.
Well, keep moving on with it.
There you go. You know, a good winter project, take the carburetor off and clean it and rebuild it and put it back on in the spring.
I'm setting it up for plowing. You know, so I've been pushing on it. I pieced together some old plow parts, so I've got it just there, but this is just one of the last things to, you know. And then every once in a while, what happens if it sits, and then I go to start it, and all of a sudden the float bowl is overflowing.
Oh, okay.
And then another time you do it, it doesn't do that.
So the needle and seat is acting up, so it isn't shutting the fuel off the way it should. That's why it's overflowing, because the needle's getting stuck, and it isn't the gas is just going right by the needle and seat and just filling up the bowl. So
yeah, that's why I'm thinking it may be there in the next and the other one too. But anyways,
all right,
John,
good luck,
care.
Tom.
Bye-bye.
All right, come by my house when it snows.
Yeah, I know.
All right,
bye-bye.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Let's talk to Rick. Rick, is that you?
Yeah, it's me.
Hey, it is you.
Sorry, I had to hang up. My wife showed up with groceries. So, priorities.
I understand.
Yeah. First a comment, then a question for you. Comment is that, have you ever looked at the end of a runway and all the rubber from the planes, from the tires that are going 0 miles per hour, all of a sudden have to go to 60 or 160, whatever?
Been out on a runway to do something, and I had to go, what do they call it? Foreign object FOD walk.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at the amount of crap that's at the end of a runway.
Yeah, and so the tires on a flying car will need to be replaced
eventually.
Yeah.
But you know, just when they come, you know, and I don't see flying cars coming in at, you know, that hot on. Well, first off, I don't actually see flying cars at all. And and if they do, though, I think the idea of, you know, where we have sort of this drone hovering technology idea down now, where they'll just literally, like, you know, go up and down. It's gonna be a while. You know, people ask me how soon we'll see fully self-driving vehicles, and the idea of a self-driving vehicle that you push a button and leave Quincy and go to Los Angeles, I don't think we're ever going to see that. You know, even I don't care what Elon Musk says, but the idea that someday we'll see a vehicle that maybe can take you from, you know, Braintree to Boston, and maybe in a very controlled environment. Yeah, we'll see that. And then we'll see more autonomous technology that kind of maybe lets you take your hands off the wheel for seconds at a time. You know, we're already starting to see that. The problem is the technology doesn't work all the time yet. So.
Oh, yeah.
Where part of the problems are.
Well, here's my question. We went last, my wife and I went last night to watch Trans-Siberia Orchestra.
Okay.
And, you know, great show, really. Glad enjoyed it in that.
Dennis just gave it a thumbs up, so.
Yeah, I agree with him. And you should go there. But several times during the show, they had laser lights, and I had them flash in my eyes. Now, I know lasers can harm the eyes. You know, at a laser show and stuff like that, just a fraction of a second less. Does that have any short-term
effect? No. But, you know, you're right. You know, when someone takes a high-powered laser and you know, aims it at an airplane, and, you know, the pilot can't see for a minute, you know, then, yeah. You know, there. But as far as lasers used in light shows, it's just nothing more than that. It's just a bright light, and it isn't going to hurt you.
Yeah, I kind of figured that in that, but, you know, we're driving home at night, and that I'm getting older and stuff like that. So,
no, you know, we are going to start to see someday, we'll actually see laser headlights. They'll use a form of a laser for replacement of headlight bulbs. So again, it depends on what, I guess, frequency or spectrum the light operates on, whether it can do, you know, whether it does any damage. You know, I saw a hobbyist laser that could actually start a wooden match on fire. You know, you aimed it at a wooden match and it would actually create enough heat that it would start a you know, wooden match. So I saw another one that would pop a balloon. You know, those are not the kind that you know, you want to get in, you know, near your eyes. But, you know, the regular, you know, and even the pointer style laser. I guess if you know, the red laser that's, you know, people use for, you know, pointing the things on a board or somewhere, you know, those kind of things, could they do some damage? Yeah, if you stared at it for a while. But the kind for, you know, show lights and things like that, no. Can you imagine the lawsuits?
Yeah, man. It's a different thought, and then I figured that was what it was.
Yep.
But what the heck? It makes a half a decent question.
There you go. All right, Rick.
Okay, John.
All right, Bye. Take care. Bye-bye. We need to take another break, pay some bills. When we come back, we're going to talk about the car that got me here today, which is the Mercedes-Benz E400 Coupe. We'll also do I bet you're thinking it's a Michelin trivia question, but it isn't. It's going to be sort of a Mercedes-type trivia question. My name is John Paul. This is the Car Doctor Program. You're listening on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. Welcome back to the Car Doctor Program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. Well, the car that got me here today, I don't drive luxury cars that much. It seems like I had a run of small SUVs, but this one was the 2018 Mercedes-Benz E400 Coupe, and it's one of just a few luxury coupes today, unless you think about supercars. But a coupe, by definition, has two doors, and because that can be a bit of a compromise. That's the way a lot of cars are. But it is, you know, there are some cars that consider themselves sort of coupes with four doors. Even Mercedes makes one, and they call it a coupe, but it's a four-door coupe, which to me isn't really a coupe. A coupe should have two doors, and this one certainly does. The E400 Coupe is built from the E4-door platform, although in this case it seats just four adults and a little smaller in size. One feature that is visually appealing, there's no post between the front and rear windows. So when you put the windows down, it has this real nice open look to it. Performance is good, but hardly breathtaking. A time trip to 60 miles an hour takes about 6 seconds. This translates into a vehicle that makes merging with fast-moving traffic effortless, but not heart-stopping. You know, it's 329 horsepower. It's a twin-turbocharged V6. It's a 3-liter engine. Transmission smooth shifting, and there are several shift modes, sport, sport plus, comfort, and even an econo mode for those drivers trying to maximize fuel economy. Can't imagine that many Mercedes drivers care about trying to maximize fuel economy, but maybe they do. I found myself staying in the comfort mode because, well, I want to be comfortable. That seemed to be the best balance of ride handling and overall comfort. I tried the sport plus mode. It keeps the transmission in a bit of a lower gear. Feels a little more responsive when you step on the throttle, but I think you're also burning more fuel, and because I can't afford a Mercedes and I have to buy the gas, I found myself in the comfort mode, which seemed, again, the best compromise. My test model happens to be the all-wheel drive vehicle with, if experience proves out, with winter tires. This coupe should handle just about any weather. Our test car had a $9,300 option package, which included, among other things, smart cruise control, automatic emergency braking, LED intelligent headlight system, and steering and lane change assistant. One of the parts of this car that every time I started up in the dark, the headlights turn on, crisscross back and forth. It looks like searchlights going back and forth, up and down until they center themselves. And it's just, I got to figure out how to take a video of it so I can watch it do it. It's one of my favorite parts of the car. The interior of this coupe is typical Mercedes quality throughout. The seats are comfortable and supportive with plenty of adjustments for drivers of just about any size. The controls are delightful and frustrating at the same time. The shifter is a small stalk on the right side of the steering wheel. It looks like you should be turning the windshield wipers on, but it's a little thing. You pivot up and down, push a button to put it in park. You have to step on the brake. A lot of people still, if they're shifting from, say, park to drive, they don't always have their foot on the brake. They put their foot on the brake, get it out of park, slide it into drive. The car's maybe rolling, maybe it isn't. Well, you have to have your foot on the brake the whole time. Again, awkward until you get used to it, and then it seems normal. Some of the touch controls, there's a rotary dial for some of the controls. There's a dial you can swipe, or not a dial, a surface you can swipe from side to side. Too much stuff. Doesn't need all that. Needs a couple of good buttons. All of this sort of demonstrates how technologically advanced the car is, but also how distracting the controls can be. Rear seating is a bit awkward to get into, but once you're in there, it's reasonably comfortable. The trunk is smallish, and when you go to look for the spare, keep looking because it ain't got one. So hopefully you don't do any real damage to a tire.
Could I sit in the back seat?
Squished up a little bit. I can sit in the back seat. In somewhat comfort, but you're a little taller, so maybe not. So if you're looking for a very stylish coupe that during my road test seemed to turn a lot of heads wherever I drove it, and I'm thinking, and the color is cardinal red, so that probably didn't hurt either. There isn't, in my opinion, a sports car, but a two-door luxury cruiser. So if you're looking, if you're looking for a true sports car, go out and buy a Porsche, I guess. But if you're looking for kind of a luxury cruiser that's comfortable to drive, fast enough, turns some heads, gets attention, I think it's good. And as some automakers are moving away from luxury coupes, Mercedes stepped up its game with this E400. How much did it cost? $77,400.
I have a very important question.
Which is?
Does the emblem light up when you put on the lights?
Yes.
Yes?
I think so.
It looks like it does.
So. I think so. I think it does. It's got a lot of cameras in it, too. It's got more cameras than, I think it's got 1, 2, 3. It might have 4 cameras in it, so. But anyway, it's a fun car to drive. And again, if you're in that market for a luxury car, if you've decided, hey, retirement's coming around, I don't really care if I have to put people in the back seat and make it easy to get in and out of, this is a good choice. It's stylish. With you put the windows down and it just has a real open air feel. It's got a monster sunroof on it, so there's big glass roof. And it has a sunshade in it, which the first thing I did was open it up because I like having the sun come in the car. It's a nice car to drive. It's a comfortable car to drive. It has an interesting feature. Interesting/weird, I think. It has what appears to be a little container where you can put your favorite cologne in, and then it pipes it into the climate control system. I kind of wanted to try to find some like obnoxious 1980s, you know, high karate or something and put it in there just to leave it for the next person. But I guess that, I think that's what it is. That's the, I had the glove compartment open to just see how big the glove compartment was. I saw this little thing and that's what it, and then I lost the drive to figure out what it was. So, another thing too, I was out yesterday. I had to go drop something off, and I was out in the Grafton area, kind of up in that area, going out to our office in Webster, and I was in sort of what's referred to as Blackstone Valley area, and I came across something called the Yankee Express, which is a small newspaper. And Barbara, who owns it, has been running my column in the Yankee Express. I've never been in there, never seen it before. I've actually never seen the physical paper before. And I walked in, and they happened to be there, and they were on a very light schedule. There's just a couple people in there. It's a little storefront. And I said, "Hi, I'm John Paul. I write the car column in your paper." And they were like, "Hey, yeah, nice to meet you." And they handed me a pair. I didn't know there's like six editions of it. And they run it. They run my column and all the editions. So thank you to the people at the Yankee Express for doing that. Well, it's time for trivia. And trivia is kind of the prize for trivia is something called Magnet Pal. And it is a little magnet. It's about the size of a thimble. How's that? For people that know what thimbles are, about the size of a thimble, and it uses a rare earth magnet, and a little science, and it's this little tiny magnet that can pick up 14 pounds, and the idea of it is you can actually put it on, say, your key ring, and if you want to, you know, attach it to, I don't know, a metal light switch, well, that plastic one won't work, but a metal light switch, you wanted to tuck a key somewhere under your car, you could actually, apparently it has enough magnetic ability that it can do that. You can tie it on a piece of string if you drop something someplace and you were trying to pick it up. They actually have a thing called a, what's it called? It's a grab-it stick, which is basically they took a selfie stick and put the magnet on the end of it. And but sort of the same idea. You drop something down, you know, down a hole. They actually showed a video of a someone who gets out of their cars and drops their keys down a storm grate, and they show them with, you know, this thing on the end of a string, dropped it down, picked it up, and got their keys out. I did something like that once. I had my keys in my hand, and I was playing with my keys, spinning them around in my hand, and I was getting on an elevator. And you know that little space between the door? Shoo, right down there. Went all the way to the bottom. I'm like, now what? And fortunately, there was somebody from the maintenance company, and they could put the elevator up and stop it, and they could go in and get it and said, don't do that again. So now I never carry my keys near an elevator outside of my pocket. But anyway, we're going to give away a Magnet Pal. And in fact, if you would like to find out about these, you can go to magnetpal.com. And if you actually want to buy a Magnet Pal, use the coupon code MagnetPal10 and you'll get 10% off. So, from the people at Magnet Pal. The question is, smart cars are a division of Mercedes-Benz. What was the original name for the smart car? Before it was called a smart car. And it was going to be sold in sort of like malls. You would go up to the jewelry counter and say, hey, can I get one of those and a two-door? And they would sell you one. What was the original name of a smart car before it was a smart car? And this goes way back to 1994 when they started talking about it. So what was the original name of a smart car before it was a smart car? If you know the answer to that, give us a call at 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. In fact, the smart cars that were sold here in the United States weren't at the time being sold through Mercedes. They were actually being sold through Penske. And so they were going to Penske in Detroit, getting their emissions and safety items checked, and then they turned into the smart cars we see now. Now all the smart cars you buy are actually all electric. There's no more gasoline smart cars. So, and those are actually a pretty good deal. Those, if you buy a smart car now, I don't think you actually buy the batteries. So it becomes, and if you get the government credit, yeah, actually almost you own the car. If you lease it, the government credit almost pays off the lease. So anyway, so what was it called? What was a smart car called before it was a smart car? And if we don't get somebody that's that smart, we'll give a hint at some point. Well, speaking of electric cars, everybody knows about Tesla, right? Are they making a lot of money? Tesla lost $671 million for the third quarter. It's the largest quarterly deficit, dropping from a $22 million net profit recorded in the same period last year. The company attributed the loss to ramping up for the Model 3. Automotive revenue grew 10% to $2.36 billion, but they're losing money. And it's kind of funny. There's an auto writer that I'm friends with on Facebook, and he's trying to get a Tesla to road test, a Model 3 Tesla, and he can't get anyone from Tesla to even return his call, it seems like, at this point. So he's not doing very well, and he's a pretty well-known guy. Auto Nation, they're a big new and used car company, and they are going to provide all the service for the self-driving vehicles from Waymo, which was the Google car. AutoNation has partnered with Waymo, agreeing to provide maintenance and repairs for the Google self-driving vehicle affiliate fleet of self-driving Chrysler Pacifica hybrids. It's kind of interesting, because does that really mean that if you own or if you have one of these cars and it's not running properly, does it self-drive itself to the car dealership for repair? Maybe. And Ford and Sam's Club and TrueCar partner to offer discounts through the holiday season. Ford is partnering with Sam's Club and TrueCar to offer special pricing for Sam's Club members in 36 states. This is the first time Ford has partnered with Sam's Club, though the automaker has a similar agreement with BJ's Wholesale Club that began last year. And on, you know, we were talking about tires earlier. Toyota is considering airless tires. They're exploring airless tires to help reduce weight and boost performance of battery electric and fuel cell vehicles, even though the technology is years from being ready for commercial use. Let's see here. Let's try Charles in Mattapoisett. Charles, do you have a guess?
Yes.
And it is?
I recall him being called a Swatch car, like the watch.
You are absolutely correct. It is a Swatch car. And in fact,
at some point they...
Go ahead.
They switched it up. They called it a Smart for Two car, right?
Right. Well, that's what most of them were, but it was originally called a Swatchmobile. And the car was built originally with a joint venture with Volkswagen, according to what I have here. And when the deal went bad, Mercedes Benz stepped in and formed a joint venture with Swatch, and they called it the company was called Micro Compact Car AG. And this comes from, you know, back in the mid-90s. It says, we're convinced that changing nature of transport needs means there is a market for this kind of ecologically sound car, according to Helmut Werner, the chairman of Mercedes-Benz. It'll appeal to primarily to younger drivers and families looking for a second or third car. The Swatchmobile became known as a smart car, a name derived from an internal name for the project. And it was a Swatch Mercedes art car. And then you're right, it became the Smart for Two when it made its debut in 97 and went from there. But
I wonder how many have been produced on an annual basis.
Not a lot.
We've got one that runs around town here, and it doesn't look like it would be too safe in an accident, frankly.
Well, you know, it's funny. Mercedes actually did a crash test with a smart car and a Mercedes ML sport utility vehicle. And it actually, the design of it actually did pretty well. But that was, you know, it was a head-on collision. to try.
Yeah,
to,
unless you get caught between a rock and a hard place, and you get
squished
like an accordion.
Yeah, you get squished in the side. Although I have to say, and people think I'm a weirdo because of it, there's part of me that likes these little tiny cars, and I don't know why.
Well, I have to question the efficiency of them. What do you suppose the fuel economy is?
It's funny. Everything about them is bad. They don't shift particularly well. They're not. I think they only get in the mid 30s per gallon. And they actually.
That's motorcycle territory for like a sport bike.
Yeah, and the original one that I looked at needed premium fuel.
And they've got no storage ability.
And if I was actually going to buy a tiny little car, I would probably buy the Toyota Scion IQ, which was a little bit bigger than a smart car. It actually had a little back seat that a skinny person could sit sideways in it. That leaves out me and Dennis, who's not skinny, who's skinny but not. He couldn't fit back there.
I got to say, I think that the Europeans have it all down. They run their diesels, and they've got the little Ford Fiestas and probably a whole smattering of other Opals and what have you that, enjoying 50 miles to the gallon, and they've got decent storage.
Yeah.
It really seems like the way to go. It's just too bad Volkswagen screwed that up.
Yeah, it is because it was actually kind of I discovered it by sheerly by accident. Some insurance companies have the thing you plug into the port under the dash and it can tell you whether you're a good driver or not.
The OBD2.
Yeah, yeah, Progressive has it. And the funny thing is when you plugged it into a Volkswagen, the car didn't perform well afterwards. Volkswagen kept saying, well, that port was never designed for two-way communication like that. The flight recorder thing is actually causing some computer malfunctions. What it was actually doing was putting the car into the EPA test mode. And the EPA mode was a cheat mode. So what happened was it didn't shift the same, and the fuel economy dropped off.
People are always short-sighted. They don't think about how easy it is going to be to figure something out.
Yeah, it only takes a smart engineer, and the thing that was sort of interesting about it, I was talking to somebody. I said, how much of it was the idea that somebody's boss said to him, this is what the car has to do, and you have to make it do it? And they finally tried and tried and tried with smart engineering and finally gave up and just cheated instead. So
too much pressure from above.
Yeah, that's what it was. Hey, stay right there, and we will get your name and address, and I'll send you out this magnetic thing. Don't put it next to a credit card, I think. So.
No, I was going to ask you about that. You got to be careful where you leave your keys if you have it on your keychain.
I think so, but it is actually pretty. They sent me one in a package, and they sent me two that were loose. And the magnetic strength of it, I put one on top of a desk, and it was an inch and a half thick fiberboard or something, and the other one under the desk, and I could move it around with it.
I can see the usefulness of it. You drop something in the grass, it just disappears right in front of you, and you're like, I don't even want to move.
Yep. No, it's actually a pretty neat little magnet. So stay right there, and we'll send it out to you, okay?
Thank you.
All right. So we'll take care of that, and Dennis will get down Charles's address, and we'll go from there. So this is a headline. It's too hot even for demons. Says it turns out the Dodge Demons fire-breathing vehicles aren't exactly flame-proof. On Halloween, so this was back a month ago, three Challenger SRT Demons were en route to their owners, and they were destroyed in Michigan when a covered hauler caught fire, according to the Fiat Chrysler partner website, I guess, called Allpar. The hotly awaited 840 horsepower muscle car caught up in flames. They were part of a one-year limited production run of 3,300 units in the United States and Canada. FCA isn't commenting on the cause of the fire, but Allpar says Dodge brand head Tim Kaniskis, I guess, called each of the owners to give them the bad news and assure them that the three units would be added to the production run. Let's talk to Steve in Rhode Island. Steve.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Took the car recently for front brakes to the dealer.
Yep.
And when we got it back, the pedal's almost on the floor.
Whoa. Didn't anyone road test it?
I guess not. So they took it back in. They claimed they adjusted the rear brakes, and they also claimed they had never touched the rear brakes. So driving it home, the pedal did improve slightly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still quite low. Do cars still adjust automatically backing up? Or?
Yeah, but you had a good pedal before, right?
Oh, yes.
What kind of car is it?
Chevy Aveo.
2009. Yeah, I mean, they will, either they'll adjust backing up or they'll adjust using the park and brake, one or the other. What you could try, though, is apply the park and brake and see if the pedal comes up.
Oh, okay.
Because that's, when you apply the park and brake, it's going to, I think in that car, it only uses the drum brakes to apply the park and brake. I don't think there's an internal parking brake. What year is it? Let me take a
2009.
Peek. Let me take a peek. And what did they do when they did the brakes to the car? What kind of brake work did they do? Did they do just pads or pads and rotors or pads, rotors, and calipers? Or
pads and rotors.
Okay, so they... Because, I mean, even at that, they generally wouldn't have any excuse to even look at the hydraulic system on the car. So,
right.
Yeah, so...
It's a solid pedal once it catches. But it's very low.
Yeah, no, there's something going on there I'm not comfortable. I think there's air in the system, and I would want to go back and have them really look and see what's, you know, do they need to bleed the brakes off? I would start sort of there and see what's going on, because there is something there that is causing that low pedal, and I'm willing to bet there's maybe air in the system that is causing that low pedal. It is a rear drum system, so the idea that, you know, could the rear drums be out of adjustment? Sure, they could, but that should have been 100% when they did it afterwards. So. I would go back. You know, there's no reason to have a squishy, soft pedal. I would go back. To me, it sounds like maybe the brake calipers are not sliding back and forth on the mounts the way they should. There's something that's causing a problem. And start, you know, the first thing they should do is they should start by bleeding the brakes and rechecking their work and finding out what's going on.
Okay. Well, that brings me to another question. There's no slots in the backing plates for the rear brakes to adjust.
Yeah, and they could actually be in the drum. They could be on the drum side. Or they could actually be there. There were some cars, I don't know about the Aveo, but there were some cars that basically all you did was you took the drum off, you adjusted the brakes, and you put the drum back on, and you did that a couple of times until you got a good fit, and that was it. So, but there is, you know, there is a brake adjuster for the rear brakes, and you know, there's not a whole lot, but still, I'm not buying the fact that that it's just rear brake noise. I think you have a problem with air in the system, and you know, maybe when they were pushing the caliper pistons back in, when they were resetting the calipers, maybe they changed brake fluid. Who knows what they did, but they should never give a customer a car back with a low, squishy brake pedal. That's just unacceptable.
And one other thing, the solenoid to unlock the shifter when you step on the brake makes a loud noise now. Never did before.
Yeah, that could be, you know, I don't buy coincidences, but I don't know what one would have to do with the other. I mean, that's located right under the shifter. Yeah, and that could be the difference, because the pedals get so much travel in it now.
Maybe sensing it.
But yeah, I would go back and say to them, hey, look, can we, you know, the pedal still is not good. Can we go back and recheck all your work and maybe bleed the brakes just to make sure everything is okay? The brake pedal should be as good as it was when your brakes were worn out. So that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Okay?
Thanks, John.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. We need to take another break. My name's John Paul. This is the Car Doctor Program. Remember, coming up very soon is the Irish Hit Parade, and we'll be right back.
round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around.
Back to the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Austin. Well, let's talk to Peter. Peter, is that you?
Yes, it is. John Paul. Yes, it's me.
You know, Dennis is going to get this phone sequence down. He's got the click down. He just doesn't have the click with the thing. So we're working on it. So
well, you're doing all right. Yeah. I had to go for a while. So a little earlier, you mentioned that you were talking about that. Were you thinking of the Bricklin?
Yes,
with the funky,
yes, the Bricklin,
funky bumper.
The Bricklin, yeah. Safety car. Yeah.
You got it. Yeah, 1974 or 75.
Yeah. There's one actually in Brookline. I still see it. It's a daily driver. It's somebody who just leaves it in a parking lot. And it was, again, it was another Malcolm Bricklin. One of the first radio shows I ever did. I did it up in New Hampshire with a coworker of mine, Dave Juvet, who worked for the AAA up in New Hampshire, and we used to do this program together on originally WMVU in Nashua, and then we went over to WGIR in Manchester. And Malcolm Bricklin was on the show one time, and he was it was right after he was importing all the Yugos. And
right.
Yugos were a failure, and he originally made all his money importing Subarus. He was
That's the original
Subaru distributor. Then he thought Yugo was going to be the next Subaru. Well, that didn't work out. And then he was building electric bicycles for a while. And
how'd that work out for him? Maybe a little too early for that.
Well, the only his big claim to fame with the electric bicycles was. They were used on Baywatch.
Oh my God!
Yeah, so that was his big claim to fame on that.
Because they had the big balloon tires on them.
They looked more like just a regular cruiser. But what we found odd was Dave and I were doing the show, and Malcolm said, "You know, you guys sound like good guys. Why don't I fly you out here and you can hang out the weekend at my place in Long Beach." And we kind of looked at each other and said, I don't think so. But his house was kind of interesting because it looked like a Yugo was coming out of the roof.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah.
That's quite a vision.
Yeah.
Well, if nothing else, he certainly was an automotive visionary.
And he's still, you know, he's still around somewhere, I think. So
His name
popped up in something I read not too long ago. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Subaru idea was a very good one, bringing those to this country. But now he's hard at work. I think I read somewhere that he's trying to become the first importer of Chinese cars into North America.
Well,
Chinese cars. Well, now that's an interesting.
Well, they're at every auto show, every big auto show I go to, Detroit or New York, there's always some little Chinese car presence. And the one I went to in Detroit last year, and I don't know, I don't remember the name of the company, but they had four cars on display. One looked like a Mercedes, one looked like a BMW SUV, and the other two just looked like typical generic small cars. But they were so close to looking like a BMW and a Mercedes. And you looked at the quality, I saw one 2 years ago, and you looked at the quality, and the paint was not great, the fit and finish, the hood didn't line up. You know, there was stuff that just didn't line up that well.
Mm-hmm.
And the second generation I saw, they actually looked pretty good. So, you know, at some point, you know, in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, we may very well see a...
I won't be the least bit surprised.
Yep.
And when it happens, you know, just like as the South Koreans did, you know, they'll work on it till they get it just right.
And now you look at you know, in other parts of the world, a Hyundai is considered a luxury car. Same thing with a Kia.
Really?
A Kia SUV in Australia, for instance, is considered almost a luxury SUV. Of course, they're powered by diesel engines. They're a little bit different, but yeah.
Well, under high end reliability, according to Consumer Reports.
Well, you know,
they look pretty good too.
They're definitely.
I wonder what. Do you have any idea what one of those would sell for in Australia or here, if you could get one?
A diesel? Scary amounts of money. I remember seeing one, and it was, I think it was in the $40,000 range. And this was probably 5 years ago. A lot more than you would think.
Have you ever come across a book called 365 Cars You Must Drive? Something that goes back to 2006, 2007. Anyway, it's a fun book. I'm trying to find another copy of this. And it has all kinds of interesting, peculiar, and the book one's in there. You mentioned the price, so I decided to check this out again. You know, originally I had it says here, it was about $10,075, which was, you know,
that was the price of, say, like a Pantera, which was also $10,000 when a Corvette was probably $5,500, so.
Yeah. Do you happen to like the looks of the Brooklyn?
No. That bumper design on the front, that's supposed to, you're supposed to be able to hit a brick wall at 40 miles an hour, and it's just hideous looking. And most of the ones that I've seen, the doors quit working.
That's a handicap in the goal.
A little bit. Same issue with, because it is a true gull wing, you have to be really careful parking in a parking lot because you can't open the doors.
Another one. Well,
all right, Peter.
Apparently you were right. I looked it up and said there are now, you can find junkers for between $4,000 and $5,000, $6,000, and they said nice Brooklyns were around $15,000.
Yep.
Excuse me. $15,000 and $20,000 should buy you the world's best.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, okay. Nice talking with you.
All right. Take care. I was just watching a green Dodge Viper drive through the parking lot. It's amazing what you see in the parking lot here. Stuff is interesting. The article I wrote in the Globe today, somebody asked me about whether there's a future for automotive technicians, and I believe there is. But Automotive News this week or last week, we're trying to predict the future, and they said service tech shortage, not in 2030. Says in 2030, most new car dealerships are reducing, in some cases limiting, on-site service for anything other than regular wear items. Autonomous vehicles don't get into accidents. We like to call them crashes. And because battery electric powertrains reduce the number of moving parts in the driveline from hundreds to dozens, no maintenance is required. In fact, the warranty covers the vehicle's electric motor, drive unit, and battery pack for the life of the vehicle. This is, again, someone predicting the future. Occasional updates on vehicle operating systems are handled over the air, a process the now defunct Tesla Motors pioneered in 2012. Apparently, this guy who's predicting the future didn't think Tesla was going to be around in 2030. The demise of the internal combustion engine is solving a vexing problem the industry has wrestled with for nearly 50 years, a shortage of service technicians. Electric vehicles require no oil changes, radiator flushes, tune-ups, transmission repairs, or brake work. There's no exhaust system replaced. Windshield wiper fluid is the only consumable liquid in the vehicle. Replacing tires, aligning the wheels, changing the wiper blades, an occasional burnt-out headlight are about the only service dealerships will offer these days. When one of these regular wear items needs attention, the vehicle alerts the owner, schedules its own appointment, drives itself to an authorized maintenance center while the owner is at work or at home. Vehicles are a lot more convenient and less expensive to own. But the passion that fueled consumer love affair with automobiles is gone. It has just become another smart appliance. I don't know that will really be true in 2030.
Seems a little overly optimistic.
Yeah, and because unless unless the government bans internal combustion engines, which I don't see them doing, even though electric vehicles are doing better, but they're so highly subsidized that they're out of the price range for most people. I don't know. I don't see it. I think for as long as in the conceivable future, a good 75% of the cars on the road will be have some internal combustion engine. It may be, I think hybrid electrics, we'll see an awful lot of hybrid electrics. And Dennis, you had your Fusion. How was that?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. I didn't feel any real difference in performance. Sometimes, I don't know if the Fusion was a little different. My mom has had several Prius at this point. But I could get on the highway and punch it, and there was a little bit of oomph to it. Not like as a muscle car or anything,
yeah.
But I could get on the highway and not feel like I was going to slow down traffic getting on the highway, whereas a Prius,
The first-generation Priuses were not – and even the new Prius, which they claim is – you know, you saw them like the, you know, bank robbery car or whatever it was. They're better. They're better, but not exactly hot rods. But yeah, the Fusion is actually one of the preferred hybrid cars that the taxi industry uses. The cab drivers like driving the Fusion Hybrid and the Camry Hybrid, so they actually like driving them and they like using them. So this is good, you know, good stuff all around with the future. Next week, I want to talk about out of the same article of predictions and possibilities. Bob Lutz, who is an interesting character, he did his prediction, and I think it's worth talking about. Well, we have a special guest on the phone. Let's see if people know who it is. Good morning, special guest.
Hey, good morning, guy. What's up?
Hey, Paul, what are you doing?
I'm just hanging out, trying to get better.
Yeah. You've been under the weather for about a month, huh?
Well, I was in the hospital.
Yeah, that's under the weather.
Yeah, that's about as under as you can get, I guess.
So you better.
Yeah. What happened was, and there's no great secret. A lot of people know this, but I had a GI bleed, which is that's high tech for a bleeding ulcer.
Right.
And I didn't know I had it. And so I found myself in the hospital for a few days while they figured out what was going on and then attended to it. And then afterwards, there were a little bit of complications, so I've had to kind of lay low for a bit.
Well, your fan base has been very concerned about you, and Bobby Brooks is on the microphone as well.
Morning,
hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
I got your email this morning. It was kind of the impetus for my phone call. I figured... I need to thank you guys for, for filling in the void, as it were, but, for taking time out of your weekend to cover for me, and I just need to know how much, I need you guys to know how much I appreciate that,
well,
a lot.
I'll tell you, Paul, it's been a pleasure sitting in here. Your listeners love you. I've gotten to know so many of them. We've had great conversations on the phone, great stories about what you've meant to them, so don't underestimate that. I've told you that before because I'm one of those people. So it's been a
well. You don't know what that means to me. I appreciate that a lot. I'm looking forward to getting back there next week. That's what I think I can do now, and I'm chomping at the bit.
Paul, stay low, take it easy, and be good to yourself. And if you feel ready next week, I'll give you a hard time as soon as I see you come in the door.
I can't wait to see Dennis again. That'd be great.
Yeah, no, he in fact, the last weekend he's like, I wish Paul was here because he told me I will always. They always come back.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They do.
And Paul,
I love that.
Paul, for me, it only means I'm going to have to finally clean my garage.
I know. Sorry about that, buddy.
No, it's all good.
All right, guys.
All right.
I love you guys.
Well,
I'll see you later.
You hear the piano guy in the background, which means I have to go, and, Irish Hit Parade has to go on. All right. Take care, Paul. All right. Coming up next. Bobby Brooks filling in for Paul Sullivan, who sounds great, by the way. He sounds real good, who should be here next week. The Irish Hit Parade, the very best in Irish music right here every Saturday morning starting at 10 o'clock on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. Till next week, make sure you wear your seatbelt, be good to your car, and drive safe. Talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.